From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. We're going to start today's show with a bit of food semantics. There are two words that many chefs and food writers would like to see banished from your vocabulary. Up first, ethnic.
I hate the word ethnic.
That, of course, is Jonathan Gold.
Everything is ethnic. And if you're looking at it a certain way, it's like the Apple Pan is the most ethnic restaurant there is, right? I mean, if we were suddenly like transplanted to Ulaanbaatar and we wanted an experience of America and we wanted something that was every bit as real as like a Korean place would be in Koreatown, we would go to a place that was like really close to the Apple Pan. Yet nobody talks about the Apple Pan as being ethnic. Nobody talks about French food as being ethnic. Saying something is ethnic is to sort of designate it as the other. And right now, especially in Los Angeles, especially with, you know, our, you know, glorious multicultural mosaic, we're all the other and we're all simultaneously not the other. So in order to indicate that one thing or another is ethnic or the other is to minimize its importance and to minimize its beauty, I think, is to put it in a different category.
Yet we love to categorize, right? We love to talk about modernist cuisine or farm-to-table chefs. But if there's one little pigeonhole that makes today's chefs cringe, it's fusion.
Well, I think of fusion as being something very specific, which is that moment in the 80s where, you know, classically trained chefs decided that they were going to introduce flavors from other cuisines into their cooking. The interesting thing that's coming along now, and I don't have a fancy word for it, though I think people have been coming up with them, is the idea of young chefs, generally of Asian heritage, who have had all the classical training and learned the French food or learned the Italian food, and then are using their technique to go back and reinterpret the food that they grew up eating. I mean, you could look at what René Redzepi is doing at Noma and the way that, you know, he worked at Aboli and he worked at French Laundry and he has all the technique in the world. Then he comes back and he wants to sort of to clarify and make a statement with the flavors that he grew up on. Is that fusion food? I don't think anybody in the world would call it fusion food. But he's doing exactly the same thing as like Brian Eng was doing at Spice Table or that Roy Choi was doing at, you know, Kogi and all of his projects.
The word fusion is kind of a bust.
That's LA chef Tim Vong.
Fusion is trying to put two things that don't go together and trying to make it go together. It's just a different time in this world now. A lot of people doing American New or anything or all these fancy ingredients, they're all ingredients that I kind of grew up with or any Asian person that grew up eating, and it's just not all new. So fusion itself is just kind of passe.
Tin has four restaurants in the LA area. Abigail, a gastropub. Wildcraft, a pizza joint. Little Sister, a Vietnamese restaurant. And Dia de Campo, a taco-slinging surf shack. In his review of Little Sister, Jonathan Gold called Tin the latest anti-fusion hero on the block.
I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley in the Alhambra and Monterey Park area.
Are you first generation, second generation?
I am first generation here.
Where are your parents from?
My parents came from Vietnam, but they through the travels from China, and they ended up there and immigrated to Malaysia. And as a refugee, they came to Hawaii, and then Hawaii to San Jose, San Francisco area. But a lot of my family has, when someone went to Taiwan, some went to Hong Kong, some went to Canada, Australia. It's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, you have like family diaspora. Are the roots Chinese?
My base, how I grew up, was mostly all Cantonese base. And we spoke mostly in Chinese at home.
And was there a grandmother cooking?
My grandmother cooked almost every day. My grandparents, God bless them, actually raised me. My parents are always, as first generation, they're always out and working. So I ended up being a product of my environment, which was a lot of first generation expat. As long as I got home safe. Didn't really have a time to come home. Just did well in school, and I get to do whatever I wanted to, pretty much.
So I'm curious to know the food that you ate growing up. What were the go-to sort of comfort dishes that would repeat over and over at home?
A lot of stir fries. My grandmother is half French and half Vietnamese, who married my grandfather, who is from China. So she had 10 kids. I have 10 uncles and aunts.
Wow.
And my grandmother cooked a lot of Vietnamese food, and my grandfather cooked a lot of old Chinese cuisine.
Wow, were you lucky?
Yeah, at the time, I didn't think so.
Why? What did you want to be eating at the time?
Of what every other American kids were eating. Hamburgers and pizza. How stupid of me, right?
No, we're all, that's how we all come together as a country.
but it was good. It's good eating all those type of food.
So your connection to Mexican food as a kid, you also were around a fair number of Latinos, I would imagine.
Yeah, I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley. The history is predominantly Caucasian and Hispanic. So in the early 80s, there's a big influx of Asian people moving into the area. And either my friends were either Hispanic. I mean, because it borders East LA, Boyle Heights. So either I had a lot of Hispanic friends or a lot of Asian friends. And then there was a lot of Mexican cuisine, Mexican restaurants, and everything else around Chinese restaurants that's just mashed up together. And to me, the food aren't very different from each other. They all kind of both have the same idea of ingredients.
What do you mean by that?
That is like a lot of Southeast Asian cuisine, or it's just cheap cuts of meat that are spiced up with the same type of ingredients as far as like cilantro, chilies, spices, and a lot of it. They both don't present really well on a plate in a restaurant, but they both have a lot of fresh ingredients.
I have to say, I disagree with you. I think your dishes at Little Sister present really well. Well, first of all, the aromatics of everything on the plate sort of comes to you before you even actually focus on the visual. And then you see all these different elements in the plate that your brain is already going, wow, I'm going to get to taste those opposing things together, like the lemon flavors and the chili flavors.
True. See, when I was doing a Mexican concept, Dia de Campo, that was idea too. It's about that. It's about the mom and pop store being the star and home style cooking and what I grew up seeing, how it's presented as far as how my grandfather or my grandmother fed me and how it looked like. I mean, I try to emulate as much as I can through my childhood.
So that's really interesting. Yeah. Dia del Campo is the Mexican project that you have.
Correct.
So you're cooking Mexican food through the lens of the home-cooked Asian food, but it's not Asian food. It's not a mashup.
No, it's definitely not a mashup. The ideas as a chef come through from that, meaning being true to what that the food is and not being so foo-foo about it and making sure the product stands out the best. So Little Sister and Dia de Campo, I mean, all the restaurants has a little bit of, or a lot of me, trying to figure out what it is that I want to bring out in that type of food.
So what's a favorite dish for you on the menu right now at Dia del Campo that you really love?
The bone-in carnitas. It's just one massive braised pork that's delicious. It's absolutely divine.
How's the pork prep before it goes in the oven?
Well, it's brined, seasoned, and then it's just cooked in duck fat. It's pretty simple.
I love that throwaway line. Yeah. And then it's just cooked in duck fat.
Yeah.
So is it a carnita that's kind of simmered in fat?
It is definitely simmered in fat for a good 6 hours. And then it's deep fried, so it's crispy on the outside. So,
wow.
And it comes with, you know, all the pickled vegetables that are seasonal, house-made tortillas, just anything you would want in a taco, but you just build it yourself.
Jonathan Gold had this just great quote when he was describing you. He called you the latest anti-fusion food hero.
I'm just trying to stay true to what some of the foods are, really, and respect it. That's why, like, Little Sister, for me, I didn't want to mess around with the quote-unquote fusion part of cooking. I want it to be straightforward. I want to use the best ingredients. I want to make sure that it tastes like how it should taste. Like, say, the imperial rolls. I mean, that is one of the things that my grandmother told me that about the imperial rolls, because it's rice paper, anybody can make these. It's the frying that is the most difficult part. So that always happens to me when I cook that particular dish, is I always think about my grandma. She always says that, and every time it sticks together, I freak out. It's just one of those things.
You mean every time one sticks to another one?
Yeah, because they're made out of rice paper, so they tend to stick when you fry them because they're really moist. Anyways, the whole point of the thing was, I want to make sure what I'm trying to emulate there is just real food that I grew up eating and I know how it should taste like. Whether it's steamed Hong Kong fish, lemongrass beef, or Szechuan noodle, these are all things that I grew up eating, so I know how it's supposed to taste like. And I know there's no shortcuts to certain things. And I know what makes it good and what makes it bad. And I'm not going to try to dummy it down for somebody. And a lot of people ask for a lot of different things to make it different. And I just don't really feel like I should make it different.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was Chef Tin Vong. He has 4 restaurants across L.A. Abigail, Wildcraft, Little Sister, and the latest edition, Dia de Campo. Coming up, hot pot and noodle dancers in the San Gabriel Valley. Plus, the season finale of Game of Thrones is tomorrow night. Stay tuned for Stallion Hearts and Lemon Cakes as we dive into the extraordinary foodscapes in George R.R. Martin's mythical world. Next.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
Welcome back to Good Food. Jonathan Gold's here to take us to the mall. No joke. The Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer is taking us to the Westfield Santa Anita Mall in Arcadia. Right across from Red Robin and around the corner from Dave & Buster's is the first American outpost of Hai Di Lao, a hot pot chain with 75 locations in Singapore and China.
When you have friends who go to Shanghai or they go to Beijing, they all end up at this hot pot place that they come back just completely raving about. You know, in China, it's known for its customer service. So there are long lines to get in. But in China, you can get free manicures. There are all kinds of video games to play with.
Free manicures at the restaurant?
Yeah, this isn't happening in the United
That's
States.
That's so bizarre. I don't even know what to do with that.
Free neck massages, a selection of beverages. People go there to wait in line, and the fact that they're actually eating hot pots is almost besides the point.
Okay, so describe what you loved about the hot pots.
Well, the hot pots here are different than they are everywhere else in town. And hot pot is a fad in the San Gabriel Valley now. I mean, there are dozens of places. Some are Taiwanese style, some are Mongolian style, some are Taiwanese equivalents of Mongolian equivalents of Sichuan. But it's all the same thing. You sit around a communal pot and you dip meat and vegetables and noodles into it to cook, and then you fish them out when they're done. Here, it's a very fancy place, you know, huge ceilings. I've heard rumors of a $4 million build-out, which is a lot.
So it's a $4 million build-out. What does a hot pot cost?
It's hard to tell. You can get, for example, a combination hot pot for two for about $30, $35.
So it's not cheap.
It's not cheap. It's one of the more expensive hot pots in town. But then you also get stuff in addition to what you got. You might get some extra vegetables. You might get some of the meatballs and fish balls that are sort of famous, or at least famous in China. You probably are going to pay the $4 supplement for the noodle dancer.
What is a noodle dancer?
You know when you watch like rhythmic gymnastics every 4 years in the Olympics, they have one
the
of the
ribbon people.
The ribbon dances. And this is a guy doing the same thing except with noodles. So it's usually, you know, a skinny, archy looking guy in a turtleneck who flips the noodles around as if they are ribbons, and it's a very nice show, and the noodles aren't actually very good, but it doesn't matter because you've watched this guy almost decapitate the people next to you with them.
So the noodles he's dancing with become noodles on your table?
Yeah, then he divides them and puts some in everybody's bowl of broth.
I'm stunned, I have to tell you.
The procedure is you go, you wait a while, and there isn't much to detain you, some beverages, some Chinese fashion magazines. You sit down at a table. You choose your broth first. There's like a seafood broth. There's the Sichuan broth, which is spicy as you might imagine. I think that's the original one. There's something called a pickle broth, which I like a lot, which is made with kimchi and its leavings.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And the most popular one is supposed to be the tomato hot pot, which tastes to me like a big can of Campbell's. But by the time everything's been simmering in it for a while, it takes on characteristics. It's pleasant to eat.
Okay, so I would opt for the pickle one. So when you had your bowl of pickle broth, what did you put in it?
You get your pickle broth. You order what to put in it. There's shaved lamb, beef, chicken, the usual stuff. You can get a seafood assortment, which is nice, especially the little manila clams that cook in there. There's scallops, live scallops. There are prawns. There are all kinds of things you can put in there.
Do you mix beef and seafood or lamb and seafood ever?
Yeah, you're actually encouraged to. There's a way that you could choose two options. So one half of the options could be the lamb or the beef, and the other half would be the seafood assortment. You go to a walk over to a bar and you pick out sauces. You concoct your own individual, very private sauce out of like, you know, salty fermented vegetables or hot chili or specially fermented soy sauce or there's a dozen things you could use. Sesame paste. You have to have sesame paste in there. You can get free appetizers of like peanuts if you want boiled peanuts or tofu with vegetables like a Chinese jardinera. And then you go back. People bring you things and you just put it in the broth. It's a nice way to spend an evening because you're with people and you're talking to them and you're all sort of engaged in one central project.
So do people have to agree on how to build this pot?
No. The interesting thing about this place is that everybody has their own individual pot in front of them. So the person next to you can have tomato and you can have pickle and it will be fine. I actually like it better when there is one giant pot in the middle and it does become a communal thing and you do get really mad at somebody who dunks fried fish cake in a pot you were trying to develop the delicate shrimp flavor in.
That was Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Heidi Lau at the Westfield Santa Anita Mall. Get a text with the restaurant's name, address, and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to 69866. That's Good Food to 69866. Plus, find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on Good Food's restaurant map. It's on the Good Food blog. And now, Game of Thrones.
Your new hand is nicer than the old one. Wouldn't you agree, Pod?
Is it solid gold?
Gilded steel. You're not eating. Why is no one eating? My wife wastes away and my brother starves himself.
I'm not hungry.
You lost a hand, not a stomach. Try the ball. Cersei can't get enough of it since one killed Robert for her.
If you watch the show or you read the books, you know that author and creator George R.R. Martin is a man who loves food. And with the season 4 finale airing tomorrow night, we thought now would be a good time to focus our attention on his culinary imagination. Alina Shatkin is a senior editor at Los Angeles Magazine and a diehard fan of Game of Thrones. She joins us now with this report.
Thought eyeball tacos and uni parfaits were extreme? Welcome to a world of fried rattlesnake, baked and reskinned swans, and raw stallion hearts. You can thank, or blame, George R.R. Martin, whose novels are the basis for the epic TV series Game of Thrones. Martin's impeccably detailed universe has its own kingdoms, creatures, languages, and fascinating culinary rituals. Prepubescent dragons snack on whole lambs, while the savage tribe of Fens consume human flesh. And sweetbreads are as popular among the Dothraki as they are for today's nose-to-tail chefs.
Kidney pie is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Do my best. A good kidney pie is all about the ingredients. Flour, lard, water, eggs, milk.
Easy enough. But the meat, peacetime or not, getting your hands on a good bottom round steak and calves' kidneys is not easy.
Martin is a masterful world builder, with meals that are as elaborate and complicated as his plots. And he loves describing the food. Like the lavish 77-course meal served at King Joffrey's ill-fated wedding. You catch glimpses of it in the show, but in the book, it goes on for pages. Here's a taste.
Chunks of chopped mutton stewed in almond milk with carrots, raisins, and onions. Fish tarts fresh from the ovens, served so hot they burn the fingers. Serving men ladled out bowls of blendisserie, a mixture of beef broth and boiled wine, sweetened with honey and dotted with blanched almonds and chunks of capon. Then came buttered peas, chopped nuts, and slivers of swan, poached in a sauce of saffron and peaches. Not swan again, Tyrion muttered.
As the show's food stylist, Karen Booth is responsible for turning food scenes like this into reality, or at least for making you and I believe that it's real.
Well, we try to stick to the book as much as possible. We had things like sweet corn fritters and fruit tarts and honey cakes. We had bowls of mushroom soup that we sprinkled snails, cooked snails on the top.
In the background, Karen created towers of cheese, piles of berries, and a baked swan that had been skinned, cooked, and had its feathers glued back on. Actually, she brought in a goose to play the role. But the centerpiece was a 3-foot-high pigeon pie. If you thought it was difficult to make one of those, try constructing a dozen. She worked with prop maker Gavin Jones, who created a fake inedible pie that was 2 yards long.
The pie itself was beautifully carved, and it had images of doves and leaves intertwined around the pastry crust. They must have made 12 of these giant pies.
But not every food scene on Game of Thrones involves ornate pastry and white doves. Unlike the food stylists on most shows, Karen often has to make food look unappealing.
Well, the stallion's heart was a perfect example of that.
She has to eat the whole heart.
Hope that wasn't my balls.
She's doing well.
She'll never keep it down.
In the first season, the pregnant Daenerys, played by actress Emilia Clarke, must eat a raw stallion's heart to ensure that her child is born strong. If she doesn't consume the entire thing, it's a bad omen.
We did a lot of research, and we found that a stallion's heart actually weighs 7 pounds. It's huge. So for her to stand and hold this huge, big 7-pound heart would be crazy, so we scaled it down. That was the first thing.
After testing several marzipan versions to determine the shape, prop maker Gavin Jones created a mold. Karen filled it with a gelatinous liquid that she had whipped up so it would have small air pockets. You know, to mimic the texture of an actual stallion's heart.
While it was setting, we put little tubes into the middle of the heart, and then we injected the tubes with edible blood.
What is edible blood, I have to ask?
I used a corn syrup and colored up quite dark. It was a very sugary, very sweet.
The final product was a giant strawberry-flavored gummy bear-like thing gushing fake blood that Emilia Clarke tears into again and again and again. Karen had made 14 whole hearts and 14 half hearts just to shoot that one scene. Then there's the everyday food of the Seven Kingdoms. Savory pies made with beef and bacon, with pigeon, or with the ever-popular lamprey. Modern cooks might be tempted by dishes like buttered beets, sweet pumpkin soup, honeyed chicken, and trout wrapped in bacon. In fact, two fans were so inspired, they decided to take matters into their own hands and their own kitchens. One night, Chelsea Monroe Castle couldn't decide what to prepare for dinner.
I had been reading the books and thought, why don't I try making something from that? You know, the food always sounds really good to me, meat pies and lemon cakes and things. And from there, the whole thing just sort of spiraled out of control.
Chelsea and her friend, Sari Ann Lehrer, launched In at the Crossroads, a blog dedicated to replicating the dishes they had read about and would later see on the HBO series. How would breakfast in the slave city of Marine be different than breakfast in Highgarden? What would Sansa Stark's favorite lemon cake look like? They dug up cookbooks from the Middle Ages, Danish, Andalusian, English, Arabic, and painstakingly developed recipes that would be functional and authentic.
You know, it's not just river run hamburgers and chicken wings from, you know, across the narrow sea. It's not just normal food with sort of Game of Thrones names tacked on.
They took a fictional locavore approach and created recipes based on the imaginary regions where the dishes originated.
I decided one day to write an email to George Martin to just sort of thank him for everything he'd done, explain what we were doing. And at the end, I sort of cheekily put in a postscript saying, you know, if you ever think of writing a cookbook, please remember us. I was both surprised and delighted a couple of weeks later when he not only wrote back, but he said he would mention the cookbook idea to his publishers.
A few months later, she had a book deal. A Feast of Ice and Fire, the official Game of Thrones companion cookbook, was published in 2012. It contains more than 100 recipes for things like doughy apple cakes, honey-spiced locusts, and oryx roasted with leeks. Feel free to substitute top round. And like the food in Game of Thrones, the dining scenes have also been imagined and exaggerated.
It seems to me that they're trying to make things look a little rougher.
Matthew Brosimer is an English professor and a specialist in medieval literature at Mount St. Mary's College.
Clearly, the people who, you know, came up with the look of the show wanted, for want of a better term, a Viking vibe about it.
He explains that in both historical texts and fiction from the Middle Ages, writers will go on at length to praise the table manners of the nobility.
If you knew how to, you know, eat a fancy meal without getting grease all over your chin and could drink without there being particles of food seen floating around in your wine, that showed that you were raised properly.
In the Middle Ages, a lord could rob and rape and pillage all day. But as long as he had impeccable table manners, he was all right in the eyes of his peers. For Good Food, I'm Elena Shatkin.
Elena Shatkin is a senior editor at Los Angeles Magazine. We've got Chelsea Monroe Castle's recipe for beef and bacon pie on our blog. Are you hosting a Game of Thrones finale party tomorrow night? If so, we would really love to know what you're cooking up. Tell me on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Up next, burgers and beer. Father's Day is tomorrow, and how else would we celebrate? Stay close.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. For a year now, I've been hearing rumblings about a place called Pono Burger. People told me they have the best burgers, and some even said, it's better than Father's Office. Now, I admit I don't eat as many burgers as I used to, so it took me a while to check it out. When I did, oh my, it was very good. Hawaiian-born Chef Makani, who helms the grill there, is crazy about ingredients, and chief among them are the white oak logs she burns in her grill.
It's a big deal, the wood, and that's what's so exciting about the wood, because in Santa Monica, we're grilling over white oak, which is hot and fabulous, and it's a no-joke kind of thing. You know, you get it on, it's piping hot, you're building that beautiful crust, and you're only flipping it once. That's my thing. Like, don't touch it. Just leave it alone. Let the wood, let everything do its magic.
I think that's really hard for people to do at home. People want to touch it, and then they try and flip it, and it's a mess.
Yes.
when you are using your wood, do you burn the wood down to charcoal first, or are you using the wood live?
We do both because I like some of that smoke characteristic into the flavor of the meat. It's really delicious. So both, we are constantly adding the white oak into the fire throughout the day.
So why don't you take us through the steps of being able to make a really great burger?
Well, I actually bought a grill on Craigslist for $50. It's just, you know, you can use it as a smoker or a little open pit. It's 3 feet by 2 feet. I love this thing. You know, most girls get excited about a car. I love a old, you know, half-gallon tin to grill in. And we just built wood in there. And for me, I think the key is, you know, I love a nice dry rub, simple, little bit of salt, and listen to the burger, listen to your meat, right? If you season it, get it on there nice and hot, it will start to peel up. You'll see the sides kind of curl up. We do a little dimple in the center so that the whole thing's not curling, just the meat. It starts to pull away from the grate a little bit. And that's sort of your cue of, I'm ready, flip me. And then once you flip it, leave it alone. You've got those beautiful grill marks and that wonderful crust and flavor, juicy on the inside.
So let's dig down a little deeper. Let's start with the meat. Is there a part of the animal that you prefer that the beef come from?
I love the chuck. This ranch that we're working with, I went up to the ranch. I got to meet the family. They were very sweet. I sat under the trees with the animals and saw what they were eating and ate what they ate. There are wild sweet oats and wild buttercups. And I teased this family. I said, I'm coming back as one of your animals. This is the way to go. They're happy. They're peaceful. They have beautiful water, beautiful organic land. And that comes through in the flavor. It's incredible.
And is it regular grind or is it a coarser grind?
So we're actually doing, I like fat. Fat to me is flavor. And if you're doing really healthy fat, this is something that you can put in your hair like you would coconut oil, the way the Chumash Indians did. I mean, it's incredible. So we're doing a 76-24 blend and it works. That was the magic number for us.
And how long does it usually take on one side before you do that flip?
We're cooking over really high heat, so I would say within a minute you have beautiful crust, grill marks, and we're flipping it once. And by the time you get some cheese and in the salamander, it's done.
Now, I know that you love to change your burgers up, and I would imagine there's some little seasonal component to that, too. So how are you dressing the burgers up for summer?
Right now, we have a paniolo burger, which in Hawaiian means cowboy, and this was inspired by a long day and sipping a scotch. I do love a nice scotch at the end of my day, and I started thinking, how do I get more of this scotch into my food? So it began with a Kona coffee and bourbon barbecue sauce, and we started soaking the onions in beer, and then buttermilk battering those, and it turned into this layer of smoked cheddar from England. Again, you're getting a lot of that beautiful white oak that sort of marries with the white oak that we're grilling over, and it's pretty yummy.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing burger. It has that perfect onion ring in it. Really delicious.
Thank you.
You're Hawaiian.
I'm a mutt, mostly. But yes, I was born and raised on the Big Island of Hawaii.
Why did you leave?
Because I tempted the gods. I was talking to Mokuai. Somebody came in, and I thought it was a joke. And they started taking pictures, and they were from Los Angeles. And they were saying, you got to come. You know, you got to come to L.A. and do burgers. And I thought, why would I go to L.A.? It's like the land of the great cheeseburger, and I'm just this little island girl from Kona. And I thought, they're just being nice to me because I'm the local, right? And a year later, here I am, relocated the family and opened Pono Burger. And I found that when I came out, I didn't see anybody doing exactly what we were doing. We do things a little bit different. There's nothing frozen in our kitchen. We don't own a freezer. There's ice for the organic lemonade. But for the most part, whole organic potatoes come in, big sides of, you know, product and food from the farmer's market. We have a lot of prep. My prep cooks swear my name throughout the day. It's sort of the mantra, and we laugh and we have a good time.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I think about Hawaii and working in Hawaii, and then I think about you being in Santa Monica and working here, did you go, like, bring a different energy to the whole, what is usually an insane environment?
You know, the first week that we started, we opened on May Day, and it was so cute. I have this guy who's great in my kitchen, Marlon, and he's bigger than life, and he's Brooklyn, and he's got this swagger about him, and he goes, "What'd you say to me, chef?" And I had to stop for a moment, and I said, "I think I said thank you." And he said, "People don't say thank you in the kitchen." And I started to smile, and I just hugged him, and I said, "You know what? I do, because I appreciate that this is not glamorous. It's a lot of hard work, and it is blood, sweat, and tears, and we do it because we're passionate and we're crazy and we're like a bunch of pirates all stuck on a ship together." You know, it was cute because I had asked them, I said, "Has anybody been to Hawaii?" And they said, "No." And it was such an interesting staff meeting because I thought, wow, how am I going to teach aloha when they've never been? And so I took a deep breath and I said, "Okay, I want you guys to close your eyes and imagine that every person walking through the door is your grandmother, your child, your mama, somebody that you love and care for and respect. How would you receive them?" That's aloha.
That was Chef Makani. She owns Pono Burger in Santa Monica and Ultimate Burger in Kona, Hawaii. Now, from burgers to beer. Living in Southern California, we take craft beer for granted. Often, we can find a six-pack of Stone IPA or even a tall boy from Eagle Rock Brewery in the local bodega or grocery store. But it wasn't always like that. The craft beer movement was once made up of basement brewers, filling up growlers with home brews. Now, it corners a solid 10% of the market. As the founder of Brooklyn Brewery, Steve Hindy was very early to the craft brew scene, and his background as an AP journalist in the Middle East prepared him for struggle. He documents his own journey, as well as that of his colleagues, in his new book, The Craft Beer Revolution.
My entry to the craft beer revolution was kind of unusual. I was a Middle East correspondent for Associated Press for 6 years, in the early 80s. So I covered a lot of big stories, wars in Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria. I was sitting behind President Sadat when he was killed in Cairo. But the biggest impact on my life was meeting American diplomats in Cairo who had been posted in Saudi Arabia, where they have Islamic law. You cannot buy alcoholic beverages legally. And these guys all made their own beer at home, and they continued making their homebrew in Cairo because the beer in Egypt was not very good. And I got into homebrewing through these diplomats.
That's so interesting. I would love to know what some of them named their beers.
Siddiqui, which means my friend, is what a lot of the homebrew is called in Saudi Arabia. Actually, there's a long tradition of homebrewing there. The Saudis banned alcoholic beverages in 1954 when all the Americans were pouring into the country to develop the oil fields. And when they banned beer and alcoholic beverages, Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company, issued a pamphlet to all its employees explaining how to make beer at home, how to make wine, how to make whiskey, because they knew that there's no way you're going to get these roughneck oil workers to come to Saudi Arabia and work 12 hours a day if they couldn't have a beer at the end of the day.
Wow. If you could find one of those pamphlets these days, how interesting would that be?
Actually, I have one of the pamphlets. It was a mimeographed pamphlet. And it's got a very convoluted title, something about a potion appropriate for imbibing. You could read the caption and never realize that it's a pamphlet telling you how to make beer, wine, and whiskey.
So what years were this?
Well, I arrived in Beirut in February 79, and I came home in June of 84.
So when you came home, did your feelers immediately go out to people who were starting to do craft brewing?
Well, I came back and I left Associated Press and went to work for Newsday, doing foreign news for Newsday, a newspaper. And my colleagues at AP actually bought me a really nice home brewing kit. And so I started making beer at home. And eventually sort of got into the homebrewing community in New York City. And that is where I met Garrett Oliver, who would become our brewmaster, because Garrett was the founder of the New York City Homebrewers Guild.
I'm curious about this term craft as it relates to brewing and beer. When was it sort of resurrected, or when did it become a word to describe this movement of home brewers to the next level of production and sale to public?
Well, you know, the first sort of term that was used to describe small brewers was microbrewer. And actually, that term was coined by a young guy working for Charlie Papazian, Charlie being the author of The Complete Joy of Homebrewing, which is sort of the Bible of homebrewing in the U.S. And Charlie started the American Homebrewers Association, and one of the volunteers who helped him put out a magazine called Zymergy was a young guy working in the computer industry. And, you know, he was working on microprocessors there in Boulder, Colorado. And he said to Charlie one day, he said, you know, these little breweries are kind of like microbreweries in the same sense that a microprocessor is a little computer. And that's when that term was born. And Charlie was the guy who came up with a lot of these terms. And I believe he used the term craft beer sometime in the mid to late 80s. And he used it to describe microbrewers and companies that had gotten bigger than microbrewers, because Charlie had defined a microbrewery as someone making less than 15,000 barrels of beer a year. And small breweries passed that limit, he came up with the term craft brewer.
I'm really fascinated by how each generation approached flavor. So the pioneers, the guys that I think for a lot of people who aren't really into beer, they might not even think about Anchor Steam or Sierra Nevada or Sam Adams as craft beers. So when these guys, these pioneers first started, how did they seek to find flavor? Was there something out there that they were trying to resurrect, or was it just from their home brewing experiences?
Most of those brewers in the pioneering generation and my generation had gotten interested in better beer while traveling in Europe. So, you know, maybe they visited England, or they visited Scandinavia or Germany or Belgium. You know, they realized that there were a lot more styles of beer than were available in the U.S., and that the beer could have a lot more richer and wholesome flavor than American beer did.
Were there yet regional differences between people working on the West Coast and people working on the East Coast?
Oh, yes. The regional differences developed quite early. The brewers on the West Coast fell in love with hops at a very early stage, led by Ken Grossman of Sierra Nevada and Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, which is a very, very hoppy beer compared to beers that were available in the U.S. in the 80s. And in the East, the beers tended to be a lot more balanced, we'll say, between the malt character in the hop character. So between the sweetness and the bitterness of the ingredients in the beer. The beginnings of brewing in the East were more about lager beers than in the West, where they were about ales, and in particular, hoppy ales.
Let's talk a little bit about business, because I find the beer, the arc of the industrial beer world kind of fascinating. There were all these mergers in recent years, sort of at the same time that craft beer was just exploding all over the place. So where is it at now? Has craft beer made any incursion at all into that huge monolithic stuff that many of us don't even think of as beer?
You know, Evan, when I started in business in 1988, a lot of people said, "Are you crazy? How can you possibly compete with these giant companies?" And I said, "We're not going to compete with Anheuser-Busch and Miller and Coors. We're going to compete with the imports." And at that time, 1988, imports were about 3% of the U.S. market. The other 97% was the national brands. And today, 26 years later, imports have actually grown to 13%. Craft beer is about 10%. It's a lot more if you count dollars. I'm counting volume. And the big two breweries, and there are only two big breweries now in America, AB InBev and Miller Coors, have fallen to about 74%. So we've definitely pushed them back significantly over the last 25 years, and that's why I have the temerity to call it a craft beer revolution.
Steve, thank you so much for spending all this time with us. It's a fascinating book.
You're welcome.
Steve Hendy's the founder of Brooklyn Brewery. His new book is The Craft Beer Revolution: How a Band of Microbrewers is Transforming the World's Favorite Drink. Coming up, it's peak fruit time for bakers at LA Farmers Markets. Find out what's in season next.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's time to pay a visit to Laura Avery. She's the market manager at the Santa Monica Farmers Market and joins us each week with a report on what's in season in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It is full fruit season now, and the farmers and the customers could not be happier. We have quite a selection of stone fruit. That's a peaches, plums, cherries, nectarines, pluots at the market. And we're talking now with Akasha Richmond, who's the chef owner of Akasha Restaurant in Culver City. Akasha, how can you help us overcome our fear of buying too much fruit? And give us some ideas of what we can do with this, because you know we're going to overbuy.
Well, I always buy too much fruit because you come here and everything is so good right now. So I just buy. So cherries. If I buy too many cherries, we pit them, we throw them in the freezer. You could mix them with nectarines and make a cobbler. You could make a little jam out of it. Sometimes I cook fruit halfway to jam, and then you fold that into ice cream, which is really great. Or use it as a topping for ice cream. Or make some scones, some cherry scones. So you could do that with anything. Cherries, nectarines, apricots, peaches. There's so many things you can do with it.
And when you freeze the cherries or apricots or anything, can you literally cut them in half and just put them in the freezer? Do you have to prep them in any way?
Well, we cut them in half, or we cut things into pieces, depending on what they are, like peaches. And then I have a big freezer, but if you have a freezer at home, take a small cookie sheet and lay them flat on a piece of parchment paper on the cookie sheet, freeze them, and after they're frozen, take them out and put them in a Ziploc bag. And it becomes like the fruit you would buy in the grocery store, frozen, and then if you throw it into the bag altogether, it's going to stick. and you're going to have a mess. So it's better to freeze it flat in a single layer, and then you'll have these pieces, and then you could do whatever you want. You could throw a handful in a smoothie, too. Pie, if you feel adventurous. It's easier to just throw a crumble together. And
which is just a bunch of fruit with some kind of a oatmeal topping.
Right. Like, it's fruit, sugar, cornstarch. You know, I make the oatmeal topping ahead, so I always have it around. And you can freeze that, too. And so at a moment, let's say you're having a barbecue and you want to make a cobbler, it's all ready to go.
Right, and then it's just a matter of just throwing that fruit in a pan or in a baking dish, right in the dish, a little sugar, throwing the topping on, and then going. When you're cooking it, you want it completely thawed before you throw it in the oven?
You know, you have to have a recipe that works, that you like, and you really don't need to. You could toss the frozen fruit with the cornstarch and the sugar. Sometimes we cook that a little bit first until it's a little bubbly, take it out of the oven, and then put the crumble on top, and then bake it again. Because if you start the crumble from the beginning, a lot of times the fruit gets too, you know, watery, and the crumble starts sinking, and I hate when the crumble sinks into the fruit. So I like it better when and that crumble, if it's frozen, I love to bake things when they're frozen. Like if you make a batch of scones with apricots, you could freeze the scones and put the frozen scones right into the oven. You don't need to defrost scones or cookies or anything like that.
Okay. Yeah, that's so great. And we're just really kind of getting started with the fruit season, and the varieties are changing every single week. And I'm just hoping we can just carry this on and overcome our fear of overbuying.
And, you know, I always tell everyone that works for me, because we make jam, that fruit changes from week to week. And it's hard. You get a recipe for a peach cobbler. If you use unripe, lousy peaches from the grocery store, your cobbler isn't going to taste good. So you really have to taste the fruit. You have to make sure it's a little sweet, a little tart. It has to be a certain ripeness. It's a little tricky because it's fruit.
All right, Akasha, thank you so much. Great talking to you.
You too. Have a great day.
You too. That was Akasha Richmond. She is a chef owner at Akasha and a very daring and adventurous chef who has no fear of buying too much ever. Well, it's that time of year that the Blenheim apricots from Sea Canyon have officially arrived at the market. And Mike Cerrone is here, and we always check with you, Mike, and check on the crop for months in advance. Tell us about your crop. Tell us about how the water situation is up there in Sea Canyon, too.
Okay. First of all, this is second time in 30 years of growing Blenheim apricots that I've had an early crop. So this is early. We're way ahead of last year, but last year was late. But still, it feels like it's 3 weeks ahead. And the fruit is abundant. We have a big crop. It's going to come rapidly. You know, this is our first week, and I usually only come down here with 20 or 30 boxes. I came with about 80. So that means they're literally changing overnight. The water, well, we did have rain. We had about 15 inches, and for dry farming, that's sufficient, especially with Blenheim apricots, because, you know, they're an early crop. They're not an apple crop. I mean, I think my apples are going to be stressed for sure. That'll be a whole different story. Because we don't have a lot of vineyards and extraneous water use, we're doing all right. But all the other areas in our county where there's a lot of water draw from vineyards, we're seeing a depleted water table at a very extreme level. You know, the situation is dire, and it's June. Up where we grow avocados, the guy down the road now has cut, I'd say, 75% of his orchard to stumps. So Sea Canyon's doing well. The areas outside the canyon are, you know, it's kind of touch and go.
That's because Sea Canyon's in that little microclimate where it has deep valleys and rifts, and there's a lot of water caught in there, and it naturally stays. So you're just in a super lucky place.
Yeah, we are. We were set up to dry farm from the get-go. I mean, that's always been our philosophy anyway. So vigorous rootstocks, good soil, the right spot. So it's working. You know, we're not farming marginal ground.
Right, so the apples that you say are going to get stressed later, is that because it's going to be later in the season, further away from the rain, maybe the water table is going to drop and they're going to have to work harder to get more water?
Yeah, I'd say that's exactly it. And there's a good crop. So there's a lot of apples. Last year we were light, so they came around this year to set a heavy crop. So heavy crop, dry soil, You know, there it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Now, there's a chance we could run into early rain this year, and that could be a boost. But, you know, August, September is going to be tough.
Do you thin your trees to help the tree produce, more, you know, better, bigger fruit?
The apricots we tend to not thin. The Blenheims are small anyway, and they don't really benefit by thinning. Plus, we kind of like them small. They transport better. They come down here a better state. If they were big, they would just bruise, because we're really tree ripe. We try to bring them as close to that moment as possible.
Do they ripen from the inside out or the outside in?
Blenheim ripens from the inside out. So they'll sit on the tree and they'll be green, green, green. And then 24 hours later, they're ready overnight. So they've been ripening inside, and then they take on the color at the last moment. And that's the big challenge with Blenheim.
So if we get some and the boxes have some lighter green and then some oranger, will they all kind of tend, will the greener ones tend to then continue to turn orange after we buy them and take them home?
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of to your advantage to get them like this because they last longer, they transport better.
And how long are you going to have the Blenheims?
I think we'll go for 4 more weeks.
Okay, very good. Mike, you are the harbinger of the official party season here at the market. So thanks so much, and I'm glad we got a good crop this year.
Thank you.
That was Mike Cerrone from Sea Canyon, which is a beautiful little microclimate just south of San Luis Obispo, and where he brings in this exceptional fruit year after year, and we look forward to it every year. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We've got a ton of recipes on our blog to help you navigate what to do with all that market fruit this week. It's truly a glorious time of year for pie. In addition to the stone fruit, boysenberries will be at local markets for 1 more week, so get them while you can. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find good food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. And follow us on Twitter. I'm at Evan Kleiman, and you can follow Good Food at KCRW Good Food. Thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian, Laryl, Sarah, Caroline, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.